भगवते वासुदेवाय
Thank you.
What's your name?
Anusha.
Anusha. Very nice. Krishna, Haribo. They've grown so much. You know, we haven't seen the kids for a long time. They've all grown up. Word for word. Unmata.
Unmata.
Madness.
Madness.
Mata.
Mata.
A drunkard.
A drunkard.
Jadava.
Jadava.
Like a dunce.
Like a dunce.
There's a lot of string of words there. Like a synonym. Svasamstam.
Svasamstam.
Situation, my original constitutional position.
Situation, my original constitutional position.
Yatasya.
Yatasya.
Of one who has obtained.
Of one who has obtained.
Me.
Me.
Of me.
Of me.
Dira.
Dira.
O King,
O King,
Chikitsitena,
Chikitsitena,
by your chastisement,
by your chastisement,
Artaha,
Artaha,
the meaning of purpose,
the meaning of purpose,
Yam,
Yam,
what,
what,
Bharata,
Bharata,
by
you,
Shikshitena,
Shikshitena,
by being instructed,
by being instructed,
Sardha,
Sardha,
Dal.
Dal.
Pramatasya.
Pramatasya.
Of a crazy man.
A crazy man.
Cha.
Cha.
Also.
Also.
Ishtapeshaha.
Ishtapeshaha.
Like grinding flour.
Like grinding flour.
There's maybe 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 words that mean craziness. My dear king, you have said, you rascal, you dull, crazy fellow, I am going to chastise you, and then you will come to your senses. In this regard, let me say that although I live like a dull, deaf, and dumb man, I am actually a self-realized person. What will you gain by punishing me? If your calculation is true, and I am a madman, then your punishment will be like beating a dead horse. There will be no effect. When a madman is punished, he is not cured of his madness. Please repeat the translation. My dear king, you have said, you rascal,
you
dull, crazy fellow.
You dull, crazy fellow.
I'm going to chastise you.
I'm going to chastise you.
And then you will come to your senses.
And then you will come to your senses.
In this regard,
let me say
that although I live like a dull,
although I live like a dull,
deaf and dumb man,
deaf and dumb man,
moment.
I am actually a self-realized person.
I am actually a self-realized person.
What will you gain by punishing me?
What will you gain by punishing me?
If your calculation is true, and I am a madman, then your punishment will be like beating a dead horse. There will be no effect. When a madman is punished, he is not cured of his madness. Srila Prabhupada spoke of. Everyone in this material world is working like a madman under certain impressions falsely acquired in the material condition. For example, a thief who knows that stealing is not good and who knows that it is followed with punishment by a king or by God, who has seen that thieves are arrested and punished by the police, nonetheless steals again and again. He is obsessed with the idea that by stealing, he'll be happy. This is a sign of madness. Despite repeated punishment, the thief cannot give up his stealing habit. Therefore, the punishment is useless. Om Vajnatim Randasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshuritam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Mano Vishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Svayandhu Kagadamaham Tadate Svahadam Tiyam Namaste Shamanumati Satchiputra Matrasvadukam Vipam Tasyadam Kuru Kurim My dear King, you have said, you rascal, you dull, crazy fellow, I'm going to chastise you, and then you will come to your senses. In this regard, let me say that although I am like a dull, deaf, and dumb man, I am actually a self-realized person. What will you gain by punishing me? If your calculation is true, and I am a madman, then your punishment will be like beating a dead horse. There will be no effect. When a madman is punished, he is not cured of his madness. In every religion in the world, there's some sort of a theology or some sort of a statement about the supremacy of God, Godhood, and that God is the creator, or that God is great, or that God is the sustainer. This is a common thread in all religions. And one of the principles that are taught as something that is something that can't be incontrovertible. So you can't go against that order or that principle. And that is the idea of covetousness. To covet means to desire something of someone else's. I want to have that thing. And I should have that thing. Not just desire, but I should have it. And in religion, in most religious systems, that's considered to be sinful. It's against the law of God, or it's against the law of the land. It's against the law of common law, that we can't take somebody else's possession. But we come to this material world, and Prabhupada says, more or less everybody here is a madman. We're mad because we're trying to covet that which is not ours. We're trying to own or to obtain, to exploit something that doesn't belong to us. It belongs to the Supreme, to Krishna. And the process of Krishna consciousness is to become freed from that concept of covetousness, to become free from that concept of desiring to have something that's not mine. Ishavasya principle. Those of us who are studying the Bhakti Shastri, in the Ishapanasara, we have this concept of Ishavasya. Krishna is the Ishavasya, that everything in the material world is Krishna's. And our idea as devotees in Krishna consciousness is to understand that we have to use everything in Krishna's service. It's a very simple process. That we don't belong to it. Krishna is the Bhaktaram, Jagatapasam. He is the supreme beneficiary of all sacrifices. It means everything goes back to him. Paratama. We offer everything back to the Supreme Lord. We get from the Lord and we offer back to the Lord. And in that way we become purified. That will be the underlying theme of today's class. That we become purified, we purify our consciousness, we purify the misconception or misidentification of the material body, sense gratification, through engaging service, devotional service. Prabhupada says in the teachings of Lord Kapilade that sense gratification is meant for the animals and sense control is meant for the humans. And he says by this consciousness we become purified of this consciousness of sense gratification by engaging in devotional service. So we come to the elevate to the platform, the human platform, by engaging in bhakti, in devotional service. Not just by engaging in mundane karma activities. And we'll distinguish today, or we'll analyze, we'll hear what Prabhupada says about different types of karmas. Vikarma, karma, and akarma. And understand more clearly what makes us mad, unmata, mata, pramata, what makes us crazy in this material world, sense gratification, and what frees us from that sense control. And we have to understand this distinction between vikarma, activities that shouldn't be performed, that are against the regulations in the scripture, and akarma, or karma, which are activities that are regulated, and akarma are activities that have no bondage in this material world, that liberate us from the material world. Yagyata kamanamatra. Because we perform the activity as an arpana for God, for Krishna. The activities for the Supreme Person. When we first went to New Zealand, we lived in New Zealand for a long time. And we went to visit a very special, a holy place for the Māori people, the indigenous people in New Zealand, particularly in the North Island. And it's a tree. They worship a tree, a big tree. It's called a kauri tree. This kauri tree is huge. It's massive diameter. I don't know what the dimensions are, but it's a huge tree. It's called Tani Muhurta. Muhurta. It's a Tani Muhurta, a special tree. Not a special time, but it's a special tree in north of Auckland. It's called Dargaville. And there, we were driving back from right up north, and we're coming back into Auckland City. We thought, we'll go and have a look at this special tree. And we went there, and when we got there, a big busload of Māori people came. And I don't know if you know them very well, the indigenous people. They're from the islands, but they arrived in New Zealand a long time ago. And they're like our aboriginals here in Australia. They're Māori people in New Zealand. They're very strong, they're a warrior class. They came to New Zealand on a waka, on a boat, and they rowed these boats across the Pacific Island, across the Pacific Ocean, from islands like Tahiti or some other islands like this Hawaiian. They paddle across the ocean in these huge boats. So they're very strong, and they do haka. You might have seen haka. can do this. Before they do the rugby match, they do a haka and they poke out their tongue. Have you seen? The Māori people do a dance. They poke the tongue right out. We have Māori devotees in our temple in Auckland, and they do this special dance for, they made a shingadev haka. Because it's haka is for warriors, right? It's a strong people. And they do this to intimidate their opponents, to get them scared. So they make really loud noises and they beat their chest and arms and make them put their muscles. They're scared of you, run away, go away. So they make this dance called haka. It's very ferocious. First time you see it, it's scary. Oh my God. We had it in the temple many times, and for Mukunda Maharaj's, I remember one year, Mukunda Maharaj turned 60 or 60, I think, 60 in Auckland a long time ago, and we had a special haka for him. We came to the school hall, and we had the local Māori devotees do the haka, and they had a spear, and they put the spear on his chin. And they put the spear right under his chin, and I was like, you might not see his next birthday. So anyway, they're dancing around the tree. The people come and they sing. They're musical people. They have nice, very beautiful voices, and they sing. And so they're dancing. They came around the tree, and they are all moving around the tree. And I was wondering what they're doing. They're playing guitar and singing to the tree, offering respect to the tree. A lot of them, 50 of them at least. And so I was standing next to one man. Big man, tattoo everywhere, all tattoo on the face, all over the face and the head, everywhere tattoo, special kind of tattoo. It's a Māori tattoo. It's just one color, dark color. So it means he's got mana. It's a Sanskrit word mana. It means he's got position, pride. In the organization, he's got big mana. So I asked him, "What are they doing? Why are you dancing and playing guitar for the tree?" It's a very awesome tree, you know, it's like awe-inspiring. And he said, because we Māori people, we understand that nature is a gift from God, and that we are custodians. We don't own nature. We can't own the seascape or the landscape or the sky or the mountains. They have a very special connection with their mountains, with nature. And we can't, nobody can own this nature. But we are here as the caretaker, you know, the custodian. We are caretakers of the land. And so we're praying to Tani Mahuta. She's considered to be the personification of nature, Mother Nature in New Zealand. She's the oldest, the biggest tree in New Zealand. So people come from everywhere to see her and offer respect. So we're praying to her that we can become good custodians, that we can look after her and look after her species and look after nature. So that's very much a part of their culture, that they're not the controllers, that they're not, I mean, they don't act like this, of course, but that's ingrained in their culture that they don't own nature, at least. And they shouldn't exploit nature, they shouldn't pollute the rivers, and they shouldn't pollute the air, and they shouldn't cut down the trees unnecessarily. They have that conscious, that belief, that understanding as part of their culture. So in one sense, that's one step, you know, not Brahman realization, of course, but it's one step of appreciation or acknowledgement that we don't have dominion over nature, mankind, that we're here to live with nature and in harmony with nature. And the peace formula given by Krishna is to understand that he's the supreme beneficiary. He's the Lord and Master of all the demigods, Krishna. And he's the friend of everybody. He's in the heart of all living entities. Sarvabhutana. So that was an interesting experience for us. And I open up that indigenous people have much more connection with culture, with nature, than we do. And we have more of a tendency for controlling or exploiting material nature rather than living with nature, as the Aboriginal people have lived for millions and millions of years on this land here. And when we say that, you know, in an official gathering, like at a community meeting or a university or in a parliament, we might recognize the original custodians of the land, a particular tribe from this particular area, the Aboriginal people. And in one sense, that's a good thing, but oftentimes we say that they're the original owners of the land, or the original proprietors of this land are this particular tribe, but they're not the original proprietors of the land. They're the original custodians of the land, and not the original proprietors. So, yes, we can acknowledge that, and in all of the official events that we attend in New Zealand, we do that for the Māori people also, and they have a special event where you recognise the ancestors and acknowledge them. But as custodians, not as proprietors. Sometimes here in Australia, you see the sign that we recognize the Aboriginal people of this land to be the original proprietors of this land, but they're not proprietors. They're custodians of the land. Anyway, the point is that we shouldn't become... We have to accept and understand that there is a superior force in action in nature, and that we don't own nature. And nature's not there for our control. Here in this purport, particularly in this class today, in this verse today, we're hearing from Jatavara that when you're mad, doesn't matter what type of punishment you will dish out to a madman, it won't cure him of his madness. He'll continue to do the same thing again and again. And this is a recurring theme in our scriptures. In the Nectar Devotion, Prabhupada talks about that the repetition of sinful activity can't be stopped by atonement. Atonement by Christ Chitta can't do that. It can't nullify the desire in the heart. The atonement, Christ Chitta, any form of karma can't nullify the desire to do sinful activity, or the kutta and the bija. Neither of those two can be destroyed by prayaschitta, by any type of karmas, to rectify a situation. In the Karmakanda section in the Veda, there are so many different things we can do to rectify a situation. If we did a bad thing, then we can do something to rectify the pious activity, and that will nullify it, and we'll be back on plain level field. But it's not like that, because the seed is still there. We continue to do the same wrong thing in the length of instruction. At the beginning, the Vacho Vegam Manasakro Vegam, in the first verse of the Nectar of Instruction, the first paragraph of the Nectar of Instruction, purport, Srila Prabhupada, he quotes Prakshit Maharaj's discussion to Shukadeva Goswami in the sixth canto of Bhagavatam. And Prakshit Maharaj says, what is the use of atonement if you continue to perform the same sinful activity? It's useless. It's like the bathing of an elephant comes onto the shore and sprinkles the dust all over him again. He just came out of the water. Maharaj Prakshit asked that question. And Sukadeva Goswami is very happy to hear that and respond to that. That yes, it's useless. And then Prabhupada explains, and Rupa Goswami explains, that the real atonement is to destroy or to burn the desire in the heart for sinful activity. And that can only be done by bhakti. That can only be achieved by engaging in pure devotional service under the direction of the spiritual master. So this idea of repeating sin and repeating the wrong thing in criminology, in psychology and criminology, they have this concept of not being cured. Even though you get punishment, you can't become cured of that thing. The technical term in criminology is called recidivism. And we were practicing and studying the process of behavior management, if you like, called restorative practices. In criminology, it's called restorative justice. And in restorative justice, they studied the criminals that went into the jails, particularly in America and all over the world, in most countries in the world, even in India, many countries. They had this process of studying criminology, understanding the psyche of a criminal. Why does somebody continue to do the same sin, the same crime, even though they got punished for it? They got punished for it, they went to jail, and they come out, and as soon as they come out, they go back in. And people laugh and say, oh, it's because they've got a nice facility in jail, they've got, you know, swimming pool, they've got gymnasium, they've got flat screen TV, they've got Wi-Fi everywhere. So it's a nice place, better than the other house. So they go back. But the actual thing is that they're not cured of their consciousness, of their mentality to do sin, to do crime, to commit crime. And so they thought they can't keep building jails. It's a huge problem in America, particularly. The jails are full. They've been full for decades, completely full, and they keep building more and more jails. So they can't keep doing it. Then they had this study about 30, 40 years ago. They started a serious study of criminology. What's going on in the mind of these criminals? Why do they keep doing the same crime? We punish them, and they keep coming back for more. And we give more punishment, and they come back for more. And they do a bigger crime, and they get more punishment. It doesn't escalate. Instead of curing them, instead of restoring them, it escalates. So they came up with a philosophy or a system called restorative justice. And in the restorative justice system, the criminals, the offender, is brought to more to accountability than in the criminal system. And the offender has to meet the offender, the one who they've offended, the victim. They have to come, they bring them together. And there's some kind of, not reconciliation, but there's a recognition of the hurt and of the damage and of the consequence of what they did to this person. And then through that process, the criminal starts to internalize, starts to make some adjustment that, oh, I didn't realize that. I didn't understand the consequence of my action that had happened there. And it's done in a very kind of regulated way, in a very authentic way, and over a long period of time. Not to re-traumatize the victim and things like this, but there's a whole science behind it, restorative practices. And the principles of restorative practices have been engaged and incorporated into many of our practices in behavior management schools, for example, where children are made accountable, that they're made to understand the consequence of their actions. When they do something wrong, they're made to understand what is the consequence of their action. And by understanding the consequence of their action, they're less likely to repeat the same crime. They're less likely to repeat the same mistake. And they found this with serial, you know, with murderers, with rapists, with the biggest criminals in the jails. They found the ones who went through restorative practices were less likely to repeat the crime. So the rate of recidivism reduced considerably as they were practicing this over the years and years and decades. And so that now it's become a default system in many states. In the world, in America, in many countries in the world, in Canada, and in New Zealand in particular, for youth offenders, is restorative practices, because it helps to reduce the repeated crime. Doesn't completely destroy it, wipe it out, but it reduces repeat recidivism, because the perpetrator, the wrongdoer, the person who's in the wrong, is understanding what the consequence of what they're doing, how what they're doing affects other people, and then that makes a shift. So you can say that in the material world is like that. It's designed to help us to make a shift, that we can restore or we can transform our lording it over propensity and material consciousness to spiritual consciousness by engaging in activities and internalizing, understanding what are the consequences of my actions, understanding the workings of the material nature. Krishna says in the 14th chapter that when you understand the material nature, you'll understand how to become freed from it, the gunas. By understanding this supreme knowledge that I haven't taught to you before. Another statement, Krishna says, this is the most confidential knowledge. I haven't taught this before. When you understand this, you'll become, I understand how to become free from the laws of nature. So that is another aspect of Krishna's mercy. The material world is created in such a way that we can become reformed, that we can reduce our repeated crimes, we can reduce our repeated sinful activities. We can reduce that. We can nullify it. In the in the teachings of Lord Kapila Dev again, he says that by engaging in devotional service, you can uproot the deep-rooted desire for material enjoyment from the heart, only by doing bhakti. Otherwise, the material desires are in the heart. They can't be destroyed. But when we engage in bhakti and devotional service, it can be, and we become rectified or restored to our original consciousness. And that's what Prabhupada, by performing tapasya, we can become restored from our original consciousness and purified of our material contamination by engaging in bhakti. And that was Prahlad Maharaj's instruction to his classmates, and Prahlad Maharaj's instructions to his father to do bhakti, to engage in devotional service. And Prahlad Maharaj said the same thing. He said, it is amazing that people, even though that they're suffering from this tapakraya dukhitatma, from the threefold miseries, adhyatmika, adhivautika, adhidevika miseries, even though people are suffering from that and they're rotting in materialistic family life, they still don't become interested in becoming free from that misery. He said that is an amazing thing. That all these people are engaging in these activities that cause misery, and they continue to engage in the same activities that cause misery. And that's and so Prahlad Maharaj says that you should become merciful to his classmates. He said, look, everybody's suffering in this material world. They're engaging in activities that will continue to keep them suffering. They know that they'll continue to suffer, but they've engaged in those activities. They can't stop. And so we should, as devotees, show mercy. Daya. We should be merciful to all the sarva-bhuteshu, to all the living entities, to show this special mercy and give them the opportunity to engage in devotional service, bhakti. Because bhakti will uproot the desire for material enjoyment, which will destroy the misery. That Lord Sukhada, Rupa Goswami says, that is a quality of pure bhakti. A characteristic of performing pure devotional service is that you get happiness. It's Sukhada, you give all auspiciousness. Your life will become auspicious when you engage in bhakti. And that's Prahlad Maharaj's his prayer, is that we engage everybody in devotional service. And his instruction to his classmates is that become a friend to all living entities. Soritam. Doya. Doya kurita soritam. That show mercy to the living entities. Befriend the living entities. And how do we befriend the living entities and show mercy to them? Give them bhakti. Give them exposure to devotional service. There's a nice story in the Chaitanya Bhagavat that illustrates, and I realize that the class has been a little bit technical maybe for our younger audience, and the younger audience are very important here in this thing. So I want you to listen to this story carefully. It's about Lord Nityananda. We're in between the Advaita Acharya's appearance day and Nityananda Prabhu's appearance day. Right in the middle of a very auspicious time, leading up to Gaura-Garima. So there's a lot of mercy to be had by hearing about Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, by Nityananda Prabhu, by Advaita Acharya, and the Panchatattva. An interesting thing about the Panchatattva is that the Panchatattva Kambarupam, they're all about bhakti. Bhakta Rupam, Bhaktavataram, Bhaktakyam, Bhakti Shakti. They're all bhakti. They came to teach bhakti. Incarnation of bhakti. That's why they came. The Panchatattva are just about bhakti. It's about to teach bhakti. Lord Chaitanya is glorified by a great teacher, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, that because he came to teach Vairagya Vidya Nija Bhakti Yoga, he came to teach to become renounced from the material world, to understand what is renunciation, to understand what is knowledge, to get real knowledge, vidya, and bhakti, to give bhakti, because bhakti will help us to become free from our misconceptions and sense gratification. So Lord Nityananda came to Navadvipa, Have you been to Nagavi? Have you been to Nagavi? Lord Nityananda, have you been to Nagavi? Mayapur?
Yeah.
Who did you see in Mayapur?
Yeah.
Who did you see there in Mayapur? Which deity was in Mayapur?
Nrisimhadev.
Who? Nrisimhadev. Yeah, he's very memorable. Who else is in Mayapur?
Panchatattva
in Mayapur. Very memorable also, right? Beautiful deity, Panchatattva. You know Ganga Prabhu, he was here recently with Bandhu Swami, Italian. Gino. He was here with beautiful class Ganga gave. We heard at least one class I heard. He gave a class, I'm not sure if you saw that. But it was very, very amazing class. And he told many different stories, but Ganga, he was the one who went down to South India with all the precious stones and jewellery, and he had it melted for the casting of the Panchatattva. And he was there from the beginning. He's been in Mayapur a long, long time, maybe 30, 40 years. He was there from the beginning of that whole process of Panchatattva to putting them on the altar and installing them there, and everything in between. So we're writing a course on Panchatattva for our Bhakti learning, and he's going to give us some information. We've got a book. He's going to give us information about what happened in making the Panchatattva deities and bringing them onto the altar. They're big deities. Like Gaur Nitai here, big. When Gaur Nitai was installed in 1975 by Srila Prabhupada, they were the biggest deities in ISKCON. Biggest Gaur Nitai deities in ISKCON. And the heaviest. I mean, you couldn't carry them onto the altar. When Gaur Nitai came, there was a little crane out there. Because they're heavy. Now Gaur Nitai not going anywhere. You can't move them, bring them out for Abhishek. You can't take them on Rath Yatra. They'll break the cart. They're heavy, right? They're big. But the small deities we can. Utsav Murti, they can come out and do Abhishek and everything, but big Gaur Nitai can't. So big Panchatattva, you can't carry them around. You can't take them out for the Hathi, for the festival, the elephant parade in Mayapur. You can't take Panchatattva. Awesome. Too big, right? So, Lord Chaitanya, Lord Nityananda, he's the big personality on Lord Chaitanya's right-hand side in Panchatattva. And then on Lord Nityananda's right-hand side is? Sri Advaita Acharya. His hand is like this outside, in the Mayapur. And then on his left-hand side, Lord Chaitanya's left-hand side is? Gadadhara Pandit. And on Gadadhara Pandit's left-hand side? Srila Pandit, right? So, Lord Nityananda, he appeared in Navadvip. He wasn't born in Navadvip. He's from a place called Ekachakra, and then when he was a young boy, he went on a tour all around India. He went to many holy places, South India, West, North India, and East, of course. And he finished up in Vrindavan. And in his pastime, in the previous lifetime, he was Balaram. So he's a cowboy boy. So he finished up in Vrindavan and he was playing in the sands of the Yamuna, and he was enjoying it, and he was wondering, when will Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, where's Krishna? He was asking the pujaris in the temple, where's Krishna? I came to Mathura, I came to Vrindavan to see Krishna, I don't see Krishna anywhere here. And they said, look, Krishna has actually appeared, but he's in Navadvipa. He appeared in Mayapur. He's gone to Mayapur. So Lord Nityananda went to Mayapur. And when he came to Mayapur, he met Lord Chaitanya in a very beautiful meeting in a place called Nandanavalan. It's a temple next door to the ISKCON Chandradhara Mandir. When you walk out of our gate and go left, you can go to this temple. And that's it's a special meeting place. Advaita Acharya and his wife Sita Devi were waiting there one time to test Lord Chaitanya, hiding there. Lord Chaitanya was hiding there one time and spent the whole night absorbed in Krishna Katha, discussing with Nandana Acharya. And Nityananda Prabhu came there and hid there. So it's a hiding out, it's a hiding place. Hide out. If you want to go and chant five japa, go there and hide from the devotees in the Chandradhara Mandir. Sometimes we do that. Go there and hide because no one will come there. It's a quiet temple. but it's a good place to hide. And Lord Nityananda came and met Lord Chaitanya, a very ecstatic meeting and embracing and crying and tears and rolling on the ground and everything like that. It's described in detail. And then they started the Sankirtan movement, Harinam. Harinam started to go everywhere in Mayapur. And Lord Nityananda was very expert in this process of kirtan and dancing. He's a very good dancer. And dressing. So he wouldn't go out in old dirty old jeans and you know, mismatched shoes and mismatched socks and old clothes. He went out in very beautiful clothing. He had all this beautiful different coloured cloth, usually blue, but he had some other different clothes that he would wear. Beautiful silk dhotis and chadars and garlands. He always wore many garlands. So you can't count how many garlands he would wear sometimes. And he had beautiful jewellery, big earrings and pearl necklaces and bangles, and he had gold rings on every finger, on his thumb also. 10 gold rings on his hand, and beautiful necklaces and incredibly opulent turban. He was the best in turban making. Like here we have some amazing pujaris, especially Gaudiya type pujaris, who do beautiful turbans. But Lord Nityananda, he was the origin. He was beautiful. He could make an amazing turban, and he had people make amazing turban for him. So he was going out on Harinam looking like this incredible personality. He came from the spiritual world. He did come from the spiritual world. He is the spiritual world. He brings the spiritual world with him. So he came dressed like this, with sandalwood paste all over his body. Sandalwood paste and jewellery and beautiful costume, beautiful decoration. And beautiful scent. He would wear his natural scents, musk and a guru, and he had such a presence, and very tall and strong, powerful personality. And he did kirtan everywhere. It said he did kirtan in every house of the devotees, in every devotee house in Mayapur, in Navadvipam. He went for kirtan only, just for kirtan. And one day these thieves saw Nityananda. And they saw his jewellery, and they saw his beautiful like pearl necklaces and his very exotic earrings and bangles and ankle bells. He had these very exquisite silver ankle bells. And they were just saying, if I just had one ankle bell, I'd be rich man. Not to speak of one earring or a bangle or a ring from his finger. So they were all, these thieves were eyeing him up and thinking how much wealth he's got on him. So why don't we go to his house, go to Nityananda Prabhu's house one night, and when he's sleeping, we can steal all of his jewellery. That was the plan. We'll go to his house and steal his jewellery, and we'll become rich. We'll be very rich if we have his necklace and his bangles and things. So he was staying in the house of Hiranya Pandit, a very special devotee in Navadvip. And they were doing kirtan in the house, and then all the thieves said, okay, they made a plan. Let's all meet, big group of them. Let's meet and we'll go and wait for everybody to sleep in the house, the Hiranya Pandit, and we'll sneak in and steal the jewellery. So they went there one night and they're waiting outside and they could see inside, they could see they're doing kirtan and they could see Nityananda's jewellery and they're all talking about it. I'm going to take his bangle, I've got his foot belt, I'm going to take his necklace. I'm going to take all the rings on his fingers. So they were all saying, okay, you have that, like this, when he's sleeping. But that night, something happened, something mystical happened. Nidra Devi, who's the goddess of sleep, she made all the thieves go to sleep. So they were waiting for Nityananda to go to sleep and everyone in the house to go to sleep, but they all fell asleep. And they woke up in the morning. When the rooster starts crowing in the morning, they woke up. And already the sun was in the sky. And they were thinking, they had weapons, they had like their sword and different weapons like this. And they were thinking, well, we have to hide our weapons. Everybody can see us now. They know that we're thieves. So they hid their weapons in the bush and they ran home. They couldn't do anything that night. So they said, that was just a mistake. The reason is, what happened is, we fell asleep. They started chastising each other. You fell asleep first. You were supposed to be the guard. You fell asleep. And this one said, no, you fell asleep. They said, no, actually it was because we didn't worship Chandi Devi. We should have done a puja and to Chandi, and then we would have had a nice, a good opportunity to get all the jewels. So let's wait for some time, go back, get up weapons, and wait for them, and we'll wait for them to sleep, and we'll steal the jewels. So they went back after some time, they went back there, and when they went back there, this time it was night time. They had their weapons, and they had their strategy, they had their what they were going to do, who was going to do what, who was going to take what, when they were going to do it. And they were waiting, and they were looking inside, and they saw these guards, these big soldiers. But these soldiers were huge. They were twice the size of a normal human being, and they were big body and strong. And they had weapons, and they were screaming out the name of Krishna, like loud, doing loud kirtan, walking up and down outside the house of Rahunya. Pandit and the thieves were looking, thinking one of these guards can crush all of them, but there's six guards there. They haven't got a hope, even all their weapons, everything, no hope. So they got upset, even though they did their puja to Chandi Devi. They offered meat and wine and everything, and they were happy. But they got there and they saw these huge monsters waiting outside guarding Nityanandapuru. So they went home second time. Then they said, well, something's gone. You know, that was another mistake, but it won't happen again third time. Third time we'll be lucky. So they made another plan to go. They hid their weapons to go in the middle of the night and steal the jewels of Lord Nityananda. So then they went out the third time, and this time it was the darkest night ever. There wasn't a star in the sky, there was no moon, and it was fully cloudy, and they couldn't see a thing. They couldn't even see each other. And so they thought they'll get close, they'll get closer and closer. But as they were going closer to the house, one of them fell into a pit. And in the pit there was all these maggots and insects, and they were biting. And then another one fell into a pit of thorns, and he's getting scratched and messed up and bleeding and screaming. And then another one fell into another pit, and in the pit there were snakes and scorpions and different fierce-like animals in there. So they all fell into pits. Everyone was in, all the thieves were in different pits. And they were all in agony. They couldn't get out. It was pitch black. And then Indra, who understood that these thieves are coming to harass Nityananda, he brought his Samvartaka clouds. Not exactly Samvartaka, but he brought heavy rain and thunder. And the thunder was cracking like in Mayapur. When you hear a storm there, when you hear the thunder in Mayapur, you get scared, right? Because it's the loudest thunder you've ever heard. So Indra came with his thunder and his hailstones, and he's pounding them. They're in the pit and they're getting pounded by these hailstones, big hailstones like cricket balls, coming smashing on their head. And they're being bitten on the bottom, and they're getting scratched by the thorns. And then all of a sudden, the leader of these thieves, the dacoits, he got the realization that, okay, that's enough. This person, Nityananda, he's special. He's God. He must be God. How could this be happening? And then as soon as he thought that, Indra stopped. Indra pulled the rain back and the hailstones and the thunder left. And then the night became bright. They could start to see each other. And they came out of the pits. They were still harassed, of course. They had a bad experience. But they came out and they started to come to their consciousness. Back to consciousness. And the head of the thieves, all the other thieves said, okay, this is time to go back. We're heading back home. Go and take bath in the Ganga and go home and just call it quits. This Nityananda, we can't touch his jewels. We're not going to get rich by this person. So they went home. But the leader of the thieves, he said, no, I'm going to go straight to Nityananda in the house of Yonder Pandit and offer my obeisances and surrender at his lotus feet. So he went into the house. And when he went into the house of Yonder Pandit, the devotee is doing kirtan, he put his hands in the air and he was crying, he said, please protect me, save me, I'm taking shelter of you. And then he rolled on the ground, and because he saw Nityananda, he was in so much ecstasy. He's rolling on the ground, his hair was standing up on end, and he was shivering, not because of the hailstones, but he was shivering because he saw Lord Nityananda. He was in ecstasy of Krishna Prema. He got Krishna Prema by Nityananda's mercy. And Nityananda was saying to him, who are you? You know, you must have Krishna's mercy. You've been a devotee of Krishna for lifetime after lifetime to be in this situation. To be so ecstatic just to see the devotees. You're such a great devotee, Nityananda was saying, like, glorifying. And then he told him the whole story. The first night, What happened the first night? We all fell asleep. The second night, what happened the second night? We completely lost, we couldn't conceive of these monsters that were guarding you, these big soldiers outside. And then this tonight, what happened? The storm, the hailstorms, the pit. You know, he told the whole story to Nityananda. And Nityananda told him, all right. And then he told him about his sin. He's like, Jagannath Mata, like Paka Brahman is compared to this thief. You know? This thief did everything wrong, much more than Jagannath Mata. And he told him all of his sinful activities. And he told him, Nityananda said, you'll be free from all your sins. You won't have any sin left in you after you engage in bhakti. He says, you engage in the process of devotional service, kirtan, and tell all of your thief friends. Go to all your friends who are all thieves, tell them about bhakti, tell them about Krishna, and they'll become free from their sin. They'll become free from the desire to engage in sinful activity, to be thieves. And they'll become great devotees. And it said that that thief, the chief of the thieves, did that. He became a great devotee of Lord Nityananda. And he told them, you worship Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Lord Chaitanya is so merciful, he's come in this age of Kali Yuga to give this process of bhakti yoga so that when we engage in the process of bhakti, we become free from our sinful activities, free from the propensity to engage in sinful activity. And this is the only way to become, that the living entity can really restore themselves and become reconnected with Krishna through doing bhakti. Not by any other process of prayaschitta, not by any other process of atonement, but just engaging in bhakti, the heart will become cleansed. And when the heart is cleansed, we can engage in our original constitutional position. So that is the mercy of the devotees, the mercy of Lord Nityananda, the mercy of the Panchatattva, the mercy of this Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, is that we have a process to become free from sinful activity, or from the desire to perform sinful activity. We have that process to understand our constitutional position as servant of Krishna, and to become happy. To understand that that's yatvamam shanti vrishtati. We become really peaceful when we acknowledge that Krishna is the Bhaktaram, he's the supreme beneficiary, he's the Lord and Master of all the living gods, and he's the friend of all the living entities. Are there any questions or comments? Yes?
I'd like to get a mic.
Mike. You're on mic. You've got your mic.
Thank you, Prabhu, for the nice class. My question is that you said that sense gratification is for animals and sense control is for the devotees. But we see when we're in devotional service, we have a particular speaker, we have a particular singer. But isn't that sense enjoyment for us? Because it's not for Krishna.
I think I got most of it. I'm missing one word. It's an important part of what your question is. It's a great question. But
I think you should say
particular singer and particular
speaker.
Okay, very good question. Okay. I'll just start. Is that sense gratification? This question, this has been answered by different devotees, and it's very important that we understand the difference between sense gratification or things that we do for ourselves and things we do for Krishna. When we speak for ourselves, or when we sing for ourselves, for Maya, people will think I'm famous when I do this nice melody, when I do this nice tune, when I get this nice kirtan pumping. People will think I'm great in kirtan leader. But when I speak nicely, people will think, wow, he's very erudite. When I think for that for myself, that's sense gratification. Correct. Exactly. That's sense gratification. But when we do it for Krishna, When we fix our consciousness that this is our service for Krishna, that's bhakti, that's devotional service. So Prabhupada said it's very difficult to see the difference. The devotee and the non-devotee, their actions look exactly the same. We live in a house, we go shopping, we go to school, we do all the same things that everyone else does, but we have a different consciousness. So we're not doing it for sense gratification, we're doing it for Krishna's pleasure. We're doing everything. We're cooking for Krishna's pleasure, we're eating for Krishna's pleasure, we're dressing for Krishna. We dress beautifully. We come to the temple, we dress pleasantly, we dress attractively for Krishna. Not that we want all the Matajis to look at me, or we want all the men to look at me, but we dress like this so that Krishna will look at me. When I get dressed, nicely dressed and put nice tilak on, Krishna will be happy to see me. Because I'm so attractive, Krishna will be happy to see me here. And I do that for him. And I do that for myself. So that's something that's really important. When the kirtan is for Krishna, then it becomes kirtan. When it's not for Krishna, it becomes music. It becomes a musical performance. But we're not musicians, we're not performers. And we're not orators, we're not great speakers like this, but we do our kirtan for glorification of Krishna, that's what it means. And that's how we have to fix our consciousness before kirtan, that this is an arpana, this is my offering to God. I'm doing this kirtan to please Krishna. I'm doing this kirtan to bring people to Krishna's lotus feet. That's why we're doing it. And not for ourselves. And as soon as we think we're doing it for ourselves, or as soon as we forget who we're doing it for, then it becomes sense gratification.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, well. We have a line in Brahma Samhita which says that Krishna removes the karma from the devotees. And then, so my question is, can only Krishna remove the karma, or is it possible for the process of atonement that don't have bhakti in them?
It's karmani vidhati, kintu cha bhakti bhajan. Only Krishna can do that. Only bhakti can do that. Only by engaging in pure devotional service can we become free from karmas. No process of tapasya, no process of no charity, no amount of charity, no amount of austerity, no amount of erudition, no amount of scholarship can free us from our partners. But Krishna can, and Krishna's devotees. I mean, we get that Krishna's intervention comes through his devotees. So the spiritual masters, the initiating spiritual masters, the instructing spiritual masters, the scriptures, the holy name of the Lord, is how we become free. Not only Krishna can do that. And Krishna is the Lord, yes.
Then what about the process of atonement that you mentioned, and you mentioned in the sixth category?
The process of atonement is for karma kanda. The process of atonement is to nullify a bad reaction that we might get because we made some mistake. But in pure devotional service, that can't purify us of the desire or the propensity, proclivity to do something. It can't remove that. The only way to remove that or to nullify that is to burn it, to destroy it through bhakti. Otherwise, those any kind of countermeasures that we try to engage in can't be fully effective. Of course, there can be some effect. We can get some piety. We can develop a better position, perhaps in our next life. But it won't be free from material contamination.
All the people in the country as well have Baba.
actually mention bhava, I meant bhakti, but they do have bhava. They have, all of them have bhava, a lot of bhava for Krishna. And Shiva's Thakur's special personality, his incarnation of Naradamuni, and he's an eternal servant of the Lord. He comes whenever Krishna performs a lila or an incarnation, he will appear and perform different types of services for Krishna. And in this lila, he performs a very wonderful service as a householder, where Lord Chaitanya started the Sankirtan movement in his house, did all night kirtan, stayed up all night doing kirtan in his house. And it said that he didn't have any concern for making money or anything like that. He just did bhakti, and somehow or other Krishna supplied everything he needed. So if he had fear, and he did have at one stage, he was worshipping Vishnudev for protection because the Yavanas were coming to interfere with their kirtan, coming to interfere with their bhakti. So by Lord Chaitanya, you can say, arrange this whole pastime so that Lord Chaitanya could display his godhood to him and show him a special form. Lord Chaitanya came to him and showed him a special form that he revealed to him that he was actually the same person that his worship was Nrisimhadev, the original Nrisimhadev was Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And a special six-armed form, Sarvabhuja form. Yes? Mike? Thank you.
Karma section says if you do any karma and then certain other karmas nullify that, as you mentioned. And some other lectures, Prabhupada also mentioned karma cannot be nullified as an adverb case. So which statement is true? So every action has its own role, good or bad. Whatever karma you've done, it has actions and reactions. So which one is true? Or both statements are true? Sorry, am I able to put my question? So karma cannot section says that if you do this, you can get nullified from that reaction, so get rid of that karma. And in other scriptures somewhere, as Prabhupada also mentioned in his quotes, like any action, any karma, whatever you do, you cannot nullify. It has its own effects. So is the both statements true or?
Okay. The point of karma kanda and the point of prayaschitta is that it brings you back to the same place where you were. So it's not, it doesn't nullify, it just brings you back, it just reset, it's a reset. So you just get back to the same position where you were, and you might be doing more past activities and you might be progressing, but it doesn't mean that you're becoming, you can't become free from, because good karma is also material. It's also a binding material world. This good karma, to be influenced by the mode of goodness. Goodness is a platform for knowledge, and knowledge is to take us to Krishna, to the spiritual understanding. So it's only a prayaschitta can only put us on that platform in goodness, but not to pure goodness. To state a pure goodness or to reconnect with our original Krishna consciousness, our constitutional position, that requires bhakti to destroy the seed of desire in the heart. Because prayaschitta doesn't work with the desire, doesn't remove the desire or the propensity to engage in activity. In fact, it perpetuates it. Because when we become more conditioned by goodness, that's what's called conditioned in the mode of material nature. So we become more and more conditioned in that situation, in goodness. But the goal of the bhakti yogi is to transcend that and to go to a spiritual platform. And this prayaschitta can't take us there. That's the whole introduction to nectar devotion and instruction, Prabhupada's discussion in the 6th canto of Bhagavatam. particularly helps us to understand that, but you know, really analyzes that in detail and describes the supremacy of bhakti. That's why bhakti is superior to all other processes of karma, yoga, and jnana. It's because it modifies it.
Thank you.
Grantara Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Shri Prabhupada ki jai.